The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and sadly, homegrown radicalism strikes again. In the case of America, it seems to be the angry young to middle-aged males with guns who are the target demographic, who hear something, see something, and go off, as Robert Deere Jr. allegedly did last Friday outside of a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs, Colorado, killing a University of Colorado police officer, an Iraq war veteran, and a working mother of two who came to Colorado from Hawaii when her military husband was stationed in Colorado Springs. Deere wounded 9 others in that shooting spree before he was taken into custody.
It is a form of terrorism, and maybe in some way it's a function of the inflammatory rhetoric that we see on all, I mean, so many issues.
It's Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper speaking on CNN on Sunday. It sounds like the governor believes Robert Deere Jr. heard something or saw something that made him go off. What was it? This is not normal, President Obama said in a written statement. We can't let it become normal, but is it already normal? Do we sustain the possibility of violence with our tolerance for the abortion debate, with all its talk of millions of innocent dead babies, a market in body parts, and so on? With me now from Colorado Springs is Reverend Dr. Nori Rost, minister at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Colorado Springs. Also with us is Dr. Jennifer Conte, an abortion provider, an OBGYN physician, and fellow in family planning at Stanford University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
So, Dr. Conte, you encounter protesters in your work, yes?
Yes, from time to time, yes.
In their faces, do you calculate individually whether they are armed individuals capable of violence?
No, that's not something that usually goes through my mind. And I think that because as providers, our primary focus isn't about them, it isn't about us, it's about the patients.
Are you getting close to where you're going to have to make that calculation if a few more of these kinds of incidents happen?
I still don't think so. I think the fact, the thing that these people are forgetting is that we are a family. And the one thing that I can say about this community, about the providers and the advocates who work so hard to uphold women's health, is that we are strong. We rally together, especially during moments like this. Violent acts of terrorism are not tolerated, and you don't mess with our family.
Reverend Rost, in Colorado Springs, what are the feelings this week as the weekend after Thanksgiving comes to a close?
Well, for us, it's equally, even more so devastating because this same thing happened on Halloween Day, not outside a Planned Parenthood clinic, but because another man had an assault weapon that he used to kill 3 people. So it's still very raw for us. We are in a place of shock and disbelief, but we are gathering together in strong support of Planned Parenthood and the services they provide and speaking out against this continued gun violence.
Do you think that this Mr. Deere heard something and went off, something that is out there in the media, in the discourse about abortion or whatever issue, Reverend Rost?
Well, certainly there's been so much misinformation about Planned Parenthood over the past few months, and there's some indication that he had mentioned that after he was taken into custody. I think that there's plenty of obscene rhetoric around the work of Planned Parenthood that it's certainly out there for those who buy into that.
Well, let's get down into some examples here. I'm going to play you a clip of audio from Mike Huckabee, who's a presidential candidate, who was the governor of the state of Arkansas. And here he is basically responding to the events in Colorado Springs, but also doing what some might call a linguistic trick in setting up the equivalence between what happens in an abortion and what happens in a setting where murder is committed. Here is Mike Huckabee on CNN over the weekend.
What he did is domestic terrorism, and what he did is absolutely abominable, especially to those of us in the pro-life movement, because there's nothing about any of us that would condone or in any way look the other way at something like this. And there's no excuse for killing other people, whether it's happening inside the Planned Parenthood headquarters, inside their clinics where many millions of babies die, or whether it's people attacking Planned Parenthood.
So, Dr. Conte, is he setting up a moral equivalence, an eye for an eye kind of situation with what happens in an abortion clinic and the people who are trying to, in some way, respond to the killing of millions of babies, as he says?
We've seen several politicians speak out about this tragedy, condemning these acts of violence, but in the same sentence, in the same breath, advocating to defund Planned Parenthood and comparing these two actions. And when something horrific happens like this, the response should be, what happened here was wrong, period. There should be no but, there should be no comma. So that's where he went wrong.
In thinking about the body parts videos, which may or may not have motivated this Mr. Deere, there was some thought that he might have said something during the course of this five-hour standoff with police. Do you think the ways in which Planned Parenthood is being attacked encourages a kind of violent reaction in the sense that it's not simply criticizing them for being corrupt or financially corrupt, it's criticizing them for something that almost invites violence?
Absolutely, John. While we can't say for sure that these acts were motivated by the recent anti-Planned Parenthood videos, what we can say is that videos like this create a toxic environment which breeds violence.
And the idea of tissue trafficking is essentially a kind of distortion of something that goes on all the time. Tissue is traded, and we've gone over this when the videos came out, but still, let's remind people that tissue and body parts are exactly what happens in healthcare. These are exchanged back and forth, and it's been going on for years and years and years.
Right. And, you know, I think even more important than that is the fact that there's a culture of shame and stigma around abortion, and that it's hurting women and it's hurting their ability to access good healthcare.
And when Hillary Clinton says the videos disturb me as her reaction to it, it in a sense legitimizes this kind of speech, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, again, I think that there's this atmosphere of terror that's been created by these videos that aims to really shame patients and scare off anyone who would support them. It's, you know, it's cheap and it's cruel. And frankly, I don't think it's going to work.
Reverend Rost in Colorado Springs. So what do we do? Arrest Mike Huckabee for hate speech?
Well, first of all, I think that to equate the medical procedures that Planned Parenthood does with murder continues this slippery type of equivocation that the anti-choice, anti-women movement does. What happens in Planned Parenthood is not murder. It's women accessing a fully legal medical procedure.
Can you talk a little bit about Colorado Springs? And this is a community that is not unfamiliar to religious dogma of one kind or another. It's the home of James Dobson, Focus on the Family. It's a place of conservatism and liberal views living side by side. How does this community keep from being or feeling divided at a time like this?
I think part of that, we try to keep that from happening by just, for those of us at least in the progressive movement, in the progressive religious movement, emphasizing that it's our diversity that makes us stronger. There are a lot of good people of faith in Colorado Springs that don't try to force their dogma onto others. There are others who believe that they might have the one right answer for life, but even they don't try to force it onto others. And then there's a segment of the community that arrogantly thinks they have the answer and everyone should live by that.
Reverend Rost, this individual, Mr. Deere, came from outside of this community, yes? Is that confirmed at this point?
Yes.
And he had not lived in the community very long, right?
No, and in fact, where he lived was outside Colorado Springs in a tiny little community called Hartsell.
Dr. Conte, the Planned Parenthood facility that was the target here was the scene of constant demonstrations. Does that raise the profile of these facilities and, in a sense, put a kind of target around them for people who want to go beyond simply holding signs?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the biggest message that's going to come out of this is that no act of violence is stronger than the act of compassion. I think that it speaks volumes that the very next day, providers and staff returned to work and the clinics were still open. And despite this campaign of terror, you could call it, they went back to work because their conscience compelled them. We have really supported, by being complacent, this atmosphere of terror that's really trying to shame patients and really, you know, framing abortion like it's this wrong, non-medicalized procedure.
Reverend Rost, what's next in Colorado Springs, and how does this heal? I mean, again, this is an individual who's not part of the community, so we shouldn't blame the community, but nevertheless, there's some healing to be done.
Well, there's certainly healing that needs to be done. I think beyond what has happened in this attack and on the Halloween Day attack, if we don't start insisting that we have stronger gun safety laws, this will continue in Planned Parenthood clinics or randomly throughout our nation as we continue to close our eyes to the need for greater gun safety laws.
Reverend Dr. Nori Rost is minister at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Colorado Springs. And Dr. Jennifer Conte, if we could go out on you, what do you say to a young woman who may be in need of the kinds of services that Planned Parenthood has to offer and is somewhere where she would have to make quite a journey to get there?
You know, I think it's really important to for all of these women to know that this procedure is incredibly safe and that she is still safe if she goes back to these clinics. The clinic doors are open and we will be there for her, ready to help.
Dr. Jennifer Conte is an OBGYN physician and fellow in family planning at Stanford University, and she is an abortion provider. The attack on that Colorado Planned Parenthood facility, is it useful to call it terrorism? Is it useful to call it abortion murder?
This is Connie Rubin from North Canton, Ohio. When you repeat the incendiary words of the people who want to make abortion illegal, you are fanning the flames and becoming part of the problems. Words matter.
Hi, this is Rob Joyce from Norton. It's a shame that you are insinuating that someone should be put in jail for hate speech for having an accurate representation of what an abortion is. You know, at what point is it not murder? The day before they're born, the week before, and someone feels passionately about caring for babies, and they're demonized as a hate speaker.
From Richard in Arkansas, the attack in Colorado Springs was domestic terrorism, plain and simple. Elise Bowers says, yes, I'm calling it an act of terrorism, plainly and simply, and yep, he's mentally ill. That fact does not negate the fact that his act is terrorism.
My name is Nana. I'm calling from New City, New York. The way the Republican candidates are portraying Planned Parenthood, they are seeing Planned Parenthood as a victimizing organization, as an organization that kills babies. Everything that they say provides a hate for Planned Parenthood, and it fuels this kind of terror that's going on in relation to Planned Parenthood.
Andy Roth. I'm a Unitarian Universalist and a psychologist. The one thing that bothers me is that people perpetuate the rift by not acknowledging the other side's views at all. People who oppose abortion, they have a good reason for it. The problem is they just shouldn't kill for it.
Will in Georgia says, why won't most of the media use the word terrorism? I don't care if he was mentally disturbed. His aim was to terrorize. If the Paris attackers were mentally disturbed, would you not call them terrorists? More discussion of language and radicalism later this hour here on The Takeaway. At this point in the presidential campaign, it's estimated that Hillary Clinton has nearly $2 million in her war chest raised from bankers and stockbrokers in the securities industry. That's about $2 million for Hillary, and for Bernie Sanders, $47,000. Comments like this may explain why.
I think that the business model of Wall Street is fraud. And I think these guys drove us into the worst economic downturn in the modern history of America. I think they're at it again. I believe that when you have so few banks with so much power, you have to not only reestablish Glass-Steagall, but you got to break them up. That is not Hillary Clinton's position.
Glass-Steagall is that Depression-era reform that separated commercial banks from investment firms. President Bill Clinton ended it, and part of the money going into Hillary's campaign may be due to a suspicion that despite her talk of more bank regulations, she may just continue the hands-off policies of her husband. But Bernie Sanders doesn't project a lot of wiggle room on his views of banks. Break up the too-big-to-fail banks, he says, and bring back Glass-Steagall, just for starters. This doesn't bother 30-year Wall Street veteran Paul Ryan, a partner at the investment firm Hayfield Financial. Ryan, the banker, is a Sanders supporter and contributor who insists that what Sanders says is no different than the advice he's been giving clients for years on how to avoid the complex, corrupt, and impenetrable mess Ryan believes Wall Street long ago became.
The whole understanding of Wall Street I have comes from Judge Brandeis. You know, sunlight is the greatest of disinfectants. Something we seem to have forgotten. You know, Wall Street has gotten dark and complex, you know, in the last, 50 years, let's call it. There's been a disintermediation of the banks. Everything that was clear and understood, you know, we've now murked up. There's been a trend of money going private, all the private equity funds. You know, that's just an exercise in getting darker and darker. Less is known about what's happening, and it's conscious. Throw on top of it complexity, which I think is the great – more than size, complexity is the problem. You know, and I like the call to – Glass-Steagall separates things and makes things less complex. When you mix – you know, the investment bank and the shadow economy with the commercial bank, that's a real complicated thing. I dare say, you know, and I'm reasonably educated. I went to law school, majored in economics, worked in a bank. I'm hard-pressed to know what Goldman Sachs actually does or Citibank. And I didn't fall off a turnip truck. And I just can't figure out what they're doing right now. So, you know, Bernie Sanders, you know, swinging the meat axe, going, hey, let's just break it all up. That's not the gradualism that Hillary's saying right now, which is unfortunately, you know, she's in bed with these guys, and I don't think she's going to really make the changes, not with her donor base, that really need to happen. So.
And you would get rid of all the too-big-to-fail banks like Goldman and Citibank?
Yeah. I would separate them up because they're too complicated to understand. And, you know, there's some bright guys. And, you know, when you look at 2006 and 2008, where I was, you know, watching from the sidelines as that unfolded, nobody knew what the hell what was going on. And when you see things like AIG and some of these institutions, they're just so complicated. And it's kind of the corollary to Occam's razor. You know, that explanation, which is most simplest, tends to be most true. I think that the corollary, at least in the financial world, is that which is most complex is probably fraudulent. And,
really?
and I think that when you start to look at it, something happens in the details. And even if you disclose everything per Justice Brandeis, if it's so complicated, no one knows what's going on. And I think we've gotten to a point where, you know, even in the age of computers and all that, it's just too complicated to understand. And you've got to just break it back. The human mind isn't ready to deal with this level of complexity.
Now, did you come to this because Sanders convinced you or was persuasive on this, or did he have a message that suddenly resonated with things you were already thinking?
Well, I think it's the message resonated with what I'm thinking. You know, my BS detector is pretty hard with politicians. You know, I had a front row seat working in a couple hedge funds, watching the hands out from the politicians. I'm an upstate boy. You know, all of this, you know, complexity down here in New York. It wasn't my style.
The last really radical president that we had wasn't elected. He got in there because McKinley was assassinated, Teddy Roosevelt. And if he'd run on the program that he enacted in that first term, he would never have been elected.
Yeah.
Americans don't like radicals.
Yeah. Well, I do. but I think, you know, what America likes and what America needs you know, maybe two different things. And, you know, I would like to see him run hard. I would think that a lot of people, though, you know, there's a lot of voices of discontent. You know, I mean, of course, mind you, you know, at any given time, 80% of the country is not satisfied in the direction. And that's been the only constant over about the last 50 years.
Right.
So a lot of people are discontent. But I think the voice goes is that the American dream in many respects is dead. You know, I think that's a big lie that's foisted off on a lot of people. I don't think the escalator works nearly as well as it should. I came naively to Wall Street thinking I could help. Local Buffalo boy wants to help, you know, small businesses do well. And I just realized that my Wall Street education, you know, I got to watch what happened since 1987 through now. I got to see, you know, a institution like Barclays, where I'd started, turn into – you know, it's just the start of, you know, the movement that 1996 with Graham Bletchley, I think it is, you know, the basically the Clinton overthrowing of, you know, Glass-Steagall. And, you know, I saw all that stuff start to change. I'd gone to law school. I get out of law school. I go work for a hedge fund. But then got the front row seat on where speculation fit. And it became speculation much more than the formation of capital for businesses, which got really annoying to me. And you know, I just saw that money could be formed for, you know, cockamamie schemes if it was, tax arbitrages or whatever they were going to do that didn't have much productive use.
Paul Ryan, a partner at Hayfield Financial, thanks so much.
Thanks.
We've got one huge debt crisis looming and two big mysteries accompanying it as the clock ticks down for Puerto Rico. Why is Puerto Rico's $72 billion debt crisis not having more of an impact on U.S. financial markets? That's mystery number one. And mystery number two, will Puerto Rico have to actually borrow against future payments it can't make to pay a $354 million bill coming due tomorrow? Vicente Feliciano is president of Advantage Business Consulting, an economic consulting firm in Puerto Rico. He joins me now from San Juan. Vicente, can the negotiators agree on the ugly way out of this mess?
I don't think so. I think the polemics of it are such that you will need some intervention by the federal court, either as a first resort or as a way of pushing people towards agreements.
Now, bankruptcy is not an option because of the statutes here, but essentially we are in a bankruptcy zone if at some point Puerto Rico will not be able to pay its obligations, even if it meets this particular deadline. Can the courts enforce a kind of a settlement without resorting to bankruptcy?
As an economist, I can tell you that when there's no money, there's no money. So even if the people of Puerto Rico would want to pay, if they don't have the money to pay, if the government doesn't have the money, we are in bankruptcy territory.
What does this look like in terms of defaults and financial crises of a localized nature that we might be familiar with in this hemisphere?
Well, think of Detroit. Detroit had its economic model collapse, and so at one point it was necessary to go through debt restructuring, government spending cuts, and reinventing of itself. And I think that while Puerto Rico's situation is not as dire as Detroit, it certainly looks closer to Detroit 2010 than it looks to New York in the 1970s or Washington in the 1990s. It is a problem of economic model ceasing to function and the need to reinvent the jurisdiction.
So consensus here is going to mean that everyone's going to have to give up on the former economic model, which allowed for borrowing and assumed that there was some kind of federal guarantee behind the bonds, which, of course, is not the case. And then people are going to have to see that a new model, including restructuring, is the only way out of this. And then it will be like Detroit has come to that same sort of consensus. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that Detroit based its economy on three major auto manufacturers, and the decline of those manufacturers led to the decline of Detroit's finances. Puerto Rico based its economy on federal tax incentives. This was phased out in 2006, and since then, Puerto Rico has not been able to find its footing. That is what needs to change.
Who's going to hurt here? Who takes a haircut if there is restructuring?
Well, on the one hand, bondholders will be hurt. They will not be paid in full. On the other hand, Puerto Ricans are already hurting. There's immigration. Population contraction this year is at Detroit levels, close to 2%. $300 million in tax refunds from taxes filed last April have not been paid because the government is using it to pay bondholders and to run government operations. And because there's little investment in infrastructure, last summer there was no ability to handle a drought, and San Juan households had 2 days of dry taps for each day of running water. So everybody's getting hurt, and eventually the bondholders will also get hurt.
So whether this payment is met on December 1st or not, something down the road is going to have to show the way out of this, and everyone will slowly come to an agreement that it may be an ugly way out, but it's the only way. Vicente, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Vicente Feliciano is president of Advantage Business Consulting. It's an economic consulting firm based in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Distortions in the climate have revealed a quiet class warfare going on over scarce water in the drought emergency state of California. Wealthy enclaves like Bel Air and La Jolla are able to consume water apparently with no concern about being fined or sanctioned by the state, while middle class and poor consumers are hit with stiff fines when they violate the new drought rules. Catherine Miskowski is a senior reporter for Reveal and says that behind the locked gates of some of California's most exclusive communities, there seems to be no drought at all.
We looked at the top water agencies in the state that serve residential customers, and we found that they were generally very reluctant to go after their biggest customers. We found that there were 365 California households that were pumping more than 1 million gallons of water a year. And these were clustered in extremely affluent areas like La Jolla, Beverly Hills, Bel Air. But for the most part, there weren't really policies in place to crack down on these people for how much water they're using. However, there are policies in place to go after people for doing things like hosing down a driveway or watering their lawn on the wrong day of the week. So you have this situation where people are literally using millions and millions of gallons. One household in Bel Air was using enough water for 90 households. They were using 11.8 million gallons of water. And they're doing so in secret, with impunity, without being fined.
And it's the case that already big users have been asked to curtail. Agricultural users have been forced to curtail here. So we're already in a curtailment situation, and these folks haven't been touched?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, everyone in California is constantly hearing the message that you're supposed to, you know, water your lawn less, rip it out and replace it with drought-tolerant plants, don't flush your toilet as much. And then it turns out that these very wealthy people have secretly been using tremendous quantities of water. And when you ask the water agency about it, they say, well, you know, in Los Angeles, we don't really have a policy against people using as much water as they want. We just have these policies against them doing these, you know, wasteful practices like hosing down a driveway.
Which is exactly what Marty Adams, Senior Assistant General Manager for the Water System at L.A. Department of Water and Power, says.
What they're doing on their property, we don't know. And there's nothing wrong with having a large property. I mean, whether it's one large property or 10 properties taking the same space, you know, the issue becomes, are we using water the most efficiently? Are they following the ordinance?
So he might do something if there was some law empowering him to do something, or is there a lever he can pull?
Well, what he's basically saying is our ordinance only restricts these practices. We don't even know how these people are using that much water. We'd like to find out more. He did say that they had sent these top users a letter saying, hey, you're among the top users. Please cut back. But, you know, this person in Bel Air that was using 11.8 million gallons that we dubbed the wet prince of Bel Air,
oh, nice.
their annual water bill is likely around $90,000. And so, you know, if they're able to afford it, they're just able to buy as much water as they want under current policy.
And what about people in the middle class at the other end who are having a very different experience of this drought?
Well, the irony here is that if you do violate one of these policies, then your name becomes public and you can be slapped with fines of as much as $300. I spoke with one homeowner in the Mid-Wilshire district. His name was David Wilson, and we'll hear from him what he felt when he got this fine.
I was really embarrassed that I was being penalized for, you know, not being a good environmental steward when, you know, we do try very hard to be good citizens in that regard.
What was his violation and what was his excuse?
Yeah, so he had a sprinkler malfunction and he had runoff going into the street and he was watering on the wrong day of the week. This is a guy who, like, put solar panels on his house and had, you know, ripped out some of his plants to replace them with succulents. So he was pretty embarrassed about that. But when I explained to him that, you know, his name had been exposed to the media and the public because of this violation, while these mega users just a few miles away in super affluent areas were, you know, using as much water as they wanted in secret, this was his reaction.
That's asinine. I mean, these are the people that people should be going after.
Is there a political momentum being generated from the drought in the sense that nobody really understood the way water was allocated in Los Angeles before this drought? And now as we're getting deeper and deeper into it, all of a sudden it's requiring people to make sacrifices, to become aware. It's created a whole new political reality, yes?
I think there is. I mean, after we wrote about these mega users, the Los Angeles City Council immediately responded and passed a unanimous resolution saying that they need to be reined in. They're now waiting for the water agency to come back to them with recommendations about how to do that. But it sparked a large public outcry. People were forming an informal drought posse to try to identify these people with satellite images or, you know, drone technologies. As far as we know, they haven't actually done so. But it does seem like when some information gets out about how much water, you know, your neighbor might actually be using when you're trying to cut back, that it can have a political impact.
How many fines have been levied? Do you know how many people have actually suffered as a result of these aggressive fines on middle-class folks versus what's been going on with the affluent?
You know, I don't have the numbers on that, but I will tell you that in some communities, like in the East Bay District in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Water District has imposed fines on people for excessive water use. So they have gone after big users. And now, you know, they've just done this recently, and there are thousands of names of people that are coming out that have, you know, had to pay these fines, and then their names become part of the public record. And when that's happened, you know, some of these people are very prominent, you know, former Chevron executives, Billy Beane, the mastermind of the Oakland A's. And, you know, here they are having to publicly defend how did they use this much water? What are they doing to try to change their ways? And so there are other policies that agencies can implement that do bring more public scrutiny.
Catherine Miskowski is a senior reporter for Reveal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water. Cool water. Old Dan and I with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water.
Water.
Cool.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding cancer research across the continuum, from basic research through clinical trials to advanced therapies that save thousands of lives. More information is available at lls.org. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
With the Paris attack still fresh in our minds and a fresh tragedy in Colorado Springs to think about, consider this. If violence isn't condemned, then it is condoned, period. More than that, if violence isn't explicitly ruled out within a religious doctrine by the faithful, by people whose background is secular, and by people of other religions, if it is not condemned as some external threat from outside the human community, something so foreign that there can be no coherent message from it, unless we see it as something like a giant meteor headed for our planet from outside the solar system that we all mobilize without hesitation to destroy, unless that is our response to violence, then its message on some level will be received. And here's the message, and you hear it from liberals all the time. In a world where opportunities seem limited and young people feel that there is no future, people like 26-year-old Hasna Eitbulacan, the cousin of Paris terrorist organizer Abdelhamid Abaoud, described as a conflicted, complicated young woman, a former wild child, a young woman who was known for smoking and drinking and partying at nightclubs before she joined Abaoud's shooters and suicide bombers. Such people will find themselves lured by extremists into violence, and that's just the way the world is right now. Make room for ISIS. Majid Nawaz was himself lured into such a group at age 16. After his arrest and imprisonment in Egypt in 2001, he became a leading voice against radicalism. He's author of the book Radical, about his life and conversion. He says there can be no accommodation with violence on any level.
It's incredibly dire. If we look at the state of affairs today, if you're satisfied by me telling you that you don't deserve death or that you don't deserve for me to kill you, look how low the bar has sunk. I mean, that should be the default of any basic conversation in civilized society. So I'd say we should push it further than that and discuss the ideas beyond the violence that justify or create the mood music to which suicide bombers dance. And in this instance, when we're talking about Islamist terrorism, I'd say it's the Islamist ideology, the notion that any version of Islam must be imposed upon society. It's that idea that we need to start challenging. It's not good enough that I merely say you don't deserve to die. That's really, it's a really, really low bar.
So the liberal doctrine and discourse of Western tolerance and pluralism basically allows for the possibility that some people in some religions will believe a certain level of zealotry and that we tolerate that out of not really discussing it.
Yeah, but this is muddying the waters. I mean, we tolerate racism, we tolerate homophobia, but that doesn't mean we agree with it, and it doesn't mean we remain silent when we hear it. The way in which we tolerate it is legally, meaning that the Constitution provides the right to free speech for somebody to be a bigot, but liberals don't tolerate such bigotry. In fact, when they hear the bigotry, even though they recognize the person has a legal right to be a bigot, they challenge them, they debate them, they tell them that they're wrong. So why, if we can do that with racism and if we can do that with homophobia, why can we not do it with people in an organized fashion who are proselytizing within Muslim communities to resurrect a medieval notion of theocracy? I don't think there is any question here about the what I call the legal right to tolerate things and the civil society duty to condemn bigotry. Those two things are perfectly compatible, and we do it all the time. We've done it with homophobia. We've done it with racism.
Although in a world that has war in all the corners of the world right now, how do you say that war and violence are not part of the normal, that there's something outrageous about taking a gun and making something happen that you want to have happen?
Well, no, this is the new normal. I've often said, welcome to the new normal. We're facing a global jihadist insurgency, and I think it's been misdiagnosed so many times. We're not faced with World War III, yet, and I hope we never have to face World War III. What we're truly facing is, for decades upon decades in Muslim communities, the Islamist theocratic idea, as distinct from the religion of Islam. Islamism is the desire to impose any version of Islam over society, and that Islamist theocratic idea has been spreading unchecked within Muslim communities for decades, and activists on the ground have been proselytizing and preaching for this idea. And so it's got to a stage now where no wonder up to 6,000 European-born and raised Muslims have gone to join ISIS, the worst terrorist group we've ever known. ISIS didn't radicalize those 6,000. ISIS plucked the low-hanging fruit. Those 6,000 were already radicalized. They were primed, and they were waiting for the declaration of a so-called caliphate. And along came ISIS and said, we've declared one. So this is the new normal. People have been prepared for this for decades within Muslim communities. And unfortunately, unless we recognize that and recognize what we're facing is an ideological insurgency, everything we do to try and address it is going to be wrong.
Do you think there's a case to be made for hate crimes among people who speak out on radical Islam in the United States, that there is a legal basis for confronting them on questions of hate crimes and intolerance and calling for theocracy?
Well, if they incite violence, yes, but what I'm talking about is challenging those who don't incite violence yet still advocate theocratic governance. It's the same as challenging people who advocate racism but don't advocate racist violence. Civil society has done this all before, but the difference has been, unfortunately, that up until now, civil society responses have been used to dealing with white racists and, on the large, Christian white homophobes. What it's not used to doing, especially within liberal society, is dealing with racism and bigotry and in this instance, theocracy, that comes from minority communities. And I'd say, actually, if we just reframe the debate slightly, liberals who are always concerned about the welfare of minority communities can square the circle, and they can reconcile their concern for the welfare of minority communities with a duty to challenge Islamist theocracy that is growing within minority community contexts.
Well, it certainly sounds righteous, as you state it, these arguments. But I'm wondering if the liberal record in controlling racism and homophobia in the United States is as good as you claim it to be. We certainly haven't stopped hate crimes and violence using guns in the United States with just a form of candid liberalism.
No, it's not. There's a lot more to do. But what I'm the analogy I'm drawing is simply that nobody within let's call it, without meaning to sound condescending, no one within polite liberal society thinks racism is a good thing. nor do they think homophobia anymore is a good thing. So the debate has moved forward from when I, growing up, used to be chased down the street by neo-Nazis with hammers and machetes and had to watch many of my friends stab before my eyes and the police do absolutely nothing about it. You know, if you'd said to me back then you'd have an African-American president, I would have laughed you out of the room. So the debate, though there's a lot more to do, has progressed. And the key point here is nobody shirks the fact that it's a duty to challenge that form of racism, even when it's nonviolent. And so likewise, at the moment, with this Islamist ideology, we can't even accept it exists, let alone that it's our duty to challenge it. I think, to make it very clear, what I'm not saying is that Muslims are somehow have an extra or additional responsibility to do this work, or that somehow they must apologize for extremism within their ranks. No, what I am saying is just as minority communities accept and expect solidarity from mainstream society in challenging racism, likewise, we should show mainstream society solidarity in challenging Islamist theocracy as well. So, in fact, all of us should stand together. It's all of our duty to challenge all forms of bigotry in civil society, and that goes for racism, homophobia, and it goes for Islamist extremism.
Majid Nawaz is a former Islamic extremist. He's now the founding chairman of Quilliam, an anti-extremist think tank, and author of the book Radical. Majid, thanks so much.
Delighted. Thank you very much.
And here's something to take with you today. Maybe you already took it.
Hello.
The question for me is, why?
It's me.
I was wondering if, after all these years, you'd like to meet, she sings. Apparently, 3,380,000 people say yes to that question, and it's just the first week. Adele's album, 25, is officially the best-selling album since sales records began in 1991. Hello from the outside. Goodbye from us. Reach out to us. Come on. 3.38 million of you? Easy. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening on this Monday after Thanksgiving. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I've forgotten how we felt before the world fell at our feet. There's such
support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.